Greetings, listeners. This is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club for June 2023. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details on when to hear the news and information bulletins are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, along with 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you missed the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. Just put RAOTC into your favourite search engine. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email? Our address is raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's news broadcast. Welcome to the June 2023 edition of RAOTC Club News. We have still not received any offers to edit ATN or offers to do the desktop publishing. We have a number of members who have offered to do proofreading. We welcome the offers of proofreading, but we need one or more editors so that we have a journal to proofread. No editor equals no magazine, which equals nothing to proofread. At a pinch, it would be helpful if someone would step forward to assist Bill Roper if they're not willing to take on the whole role. If editing and desktop publishing were outsourced to a commercial entity, the costs incurred would be prohibitive. We often have a number of regular contributors, and we have a good printer. More about this a little later on, however. The committee can organise the mailing out of the printed journal, so the editor only has to process articles that have been contributed and produce a small number of articles for proofreading. The next step is then for someone to do the laying out of the journal. Laying out in years past was called typesetting and was done by the printer. These days it is done electronically on a desktop computer and a file is created and sent to the printer, usually via email. This step is now called desktop publishing. Broadcasts. Last time I spoke, I mentioned that I did not intend to produce a broadcast 11 times a year. Unfortunately, no one has stepped forward as yet. I had a bit of a thought bubble over the Easter break when the weather was definitely along the lines of stay indoors here in Melbourne. I'm providing a broadcast each alternate month. I feel that something needs to go out every month, as do others I've spoken to. There will be a broadcast every odd-numbered month, offering an historical broadcast from years past. So we are back to 11 broadcasts a year. There are other sources of material, for example, the ABC, BBC, ARRL and RSGB. However, copyright and permissions need to be observed. This is a work in progress. Please stand by. In order to add a little more variety, I've added Natasha and William to the broadcast team. They don't have a call sign yet, but we're working on it. They are a bit of an experiment, but earlier reports seem positive. Suggestions made to committee. Often the RAOTC committee receives suggestions on how to enhance and improve the club via the email inbox. These are always welcome and arrive at discussed via email amongst committee members or via the quarterly Zoom teleconference meeting. We do our best to acknowledge and reply to all emails. We do this in our own free time as part of our hobby. Many times the suggestions are simply not practical, although the original intention is good. I'll point out several examples. One suggestion was to record the technical talks at the twice-yearly Melbourne luncheon and put them on the web for others who are unable to attend to listen to at their leisure. On the surface, it sounds like a pretty good idea. At the time, we had a limited amount of space on the web server. However, that issue has been addressed. Many of the talks these days use a slideshow presentation to enhance the talk. Just recording the audio and providing it without the slideshow would lose most of the impact of the talk. That's a simple reason as to why it's not done. Another member recently wrote suggesting the committee organise barbecues and luncheons in cities Australia-wide and thrown a bit of money to kick the event off. The few members that are on committee have enough to do in their spare time. If you would like to see this and you can organise them. We'll publish the details for other club members. Yet another idea was a buy, swap and sell forum. I'm not too sure if this was going to be in the magazine or online. What wasn't clear was who was actually going to do the task and how it would offer something better and improved over what VK Classifieds and or eBay currently provide. Committee news. At the recent committee meeting held via teleconference on the 25th of May, both David, VK3 ADM, and John, VK3 XM, tendered their resignation and advised they would be standing down from the committee due to ongoing health issues. Let's wish them both all the best into the future, and in recent times they were instrumental in securing a new venue for the Melbourne RAOTC luncheons. New members. Today I am pleased to welcome the following new members to the RAOTC. Patrick Morgan, VK5 Mike Papa Juliet, became RAOTC Associate Member number 1851 on the 6th of March 2023. Peter Westgarth, VK3 Alpha Papa Whiskey, previous callsign VK3 Tango Radio Echo, became new RAOTC full member number 1852 on the 29th of March 2023. John Payne, VK3 Alpha Echo Delta, previous callsign VK3 Zulu Lima Papa, became new RAOTC full member number 1853 on the 28th of April 2023. And finally, Greg Todd, VK7 Yankee Alpha Delta, became new RAOTC full member number 1854 on the 3rd of May 2023. Silent Keys. I regret to report the following Silent Keys. Max Morris, a VK3GMM, RAOTC member 1265, became a Silent Key on the 6th of April 2023. Mark Busenik, VK6AR, RAOTC member 1334, became a silent key on Wednesday the 3rd of May 2023. Let us pause in memory of our departed colleagues. Members are reminded the very latest club news is available via the RAOTC website. Put RAOTC into your favourite search engine to find it. www.raotc.org.au. And that's about all the club news we have for you at this time.
You are listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
This month we have several interesting articles for you. First up is Clive, VK6CSW, who'll be talking about Guy Gibson, who led air raids over Germany during World War II. This will be followed by Bill, VK3BR, who tells us about the Eiffel Tower and its early radio. Both of these articles were first broadcast in 2012. Now it's over to you, Clive.
Was Guy Gibson killed by friendly fire? Although this is not a radio topic, I'm sure that very few, if any, RAOTC old-timers who lived through World War II would not have heard of Wing Commander Guy Gibson, VC, DSO and Bar, DFC and Bar, who led the famous bouncing bomb Dam Busters raid on German dams. 617 Squadron, commanded by Wing Commander Guy Gibson, was a Lancaster bomber squadron based at RAF Scampton in Lincolnshire, specially established to destroy the Ruhr dams. Although 617 Squadron subsequently flew many other missions, the Dam Busters raid, codenamed Operation Chastise, was the only one led by Gibson. Prior to Chastise, Gibson had already achieved an outstanding operational record, but this was eclipsed by the success of this raid, which not only gave him a place in history, but saw him awarded the Victoria Cross, the highest medal that can be bestowed upon British and Commonwealth forces for gallantry in the face of the enemy. It made him the most highly decorated pilot in the RAF and a national hero. Gibson could have seen out the rest of the war from a desk, but, as in the past, he wanted to be back on operational duty. He managed to get a post at a Lincolnshire bomber base at East Kirkby on a strictly non-operational basis. It would have been a serious blow to British morale and a boost for German propaganda if he'd been killed or captured as a prisoner of war. Air Vice Marshal Cochrane and Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command Bomber Harris knew this, but after persistent pestering from Gibson, they decided to let him lead a bomber squadron into Germany. On the 19th of September 1944, Gibson, in a Mosquito, led a huge force of 227 Lancaster bombers and 10 Mosquitoes in an attack on railways and industrial targets at Wright and Mönchengladbach in Germany. They faced little opposition from enemy planes and were returning over the Netherlands when Wing Commander Gibson's plane came down. Mystery and controversy have surrounded his crash ever since. Although his Mosquito was seen plunging into the ground at Steenbergen in Holland, and parts of his remains were later found by the Dutch. Gibson's death was suppressed from the press for about 3 months, because the Germans would have had a field day knowing they'd shot down a hero of the German dam raids. Over the years, a variety of theories have been put forward regarding Gibson's death, including that he flew into the ground, possibly suffering from exhaustion, that he was unfamiliar with mosquitoes and forgot to flip the switch that turned on the second petrol tank and simply ran out of fuel, that he saw a train and, convinced that it was carrying ammunition, flew low to machine gun it, was hit in the fuel tank and crashed in flames, that he buzzed a Lancaster to see if the gunners were awake and was accidentally shot down by friendly fire, or even that it was sabotage. However, it seems that the truth about Gibson's death may now have emerged, according to a recent BBC and London The Telegraph newspaper item, which was picked up and reprinted in some of the Australian media. Nearly 70 years on, a British airman's confession has emerged that he was the one who shot down the plane after mistaking it for a German aircraft. Mr. James Cutler, a World War II researcher, has said that he has a cassette tape given to him by the airman's widow in which a British airman admits to shooting down Gibson. Mr. Cutler, who's been researching Wing Commander Gibson for a new Dambusters film, claimed the taped account has now solved the mystery. Mr. Cutler said the cassette was recorded by Sergeant Bernard McCormack prior to his death in 1992. Sergeant McCormack was in Wing Commander Gibson's formation of Lancasters and Mosquitoes on the 19th of September 1944 during the raid over Germany. On the tape, Sergeant McCormack, who later became the mayor of Holyhead in North Wales, admits to bringing down Wing Commander Gibson's twin-engined single-rudder Mosquito after mistaking it for a Junkers 88. He said he instinctively opened fire, loosing off 600 rounds of machine gun fire, bringing it down over the Dutch town of Steenbergen. The realization that the plane was an Allied aircraft only dawned on Sergeant McCormack the next day, when he and his crew were debriefed by RAF intelligence, and it was revealed that he had actually shot down Wing Commander Gibson and his navigator, Squadron Leader Jim Warwick, DFC. Racked with guilt, Sergeant McCormack kept quiet about what had happened that night, but left a taped confession of the incident, which he gave to his wife before he died in 1992. Mr. Cutler has also unearthed a previously classified combat report in the National Archives by the crew of Sergeant McCormack's Lancaster, which describes the attack. He said coordinates given in the classified combat report backed up the pilot's account. Mr. Cutler also said, "When I first heard the tape, I thought, it's just a story told by old comrades. But then, when we found the documents in the National Archives, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I realized one of the great mysteries of World War II may have been answered." Mr. Cutler is 100% satisfied Wing Commander Guy Gibson was killed by friendly fire and 99.9% sure that he was shot down by Sergeant Bernard McCormack's Lancaster. However, Roger Crisp from the RAF Scampton Historical Museum is quoted as saying, "Gibson was very egotistical. He liked to be the best at everything and he was impatient. He did not do a proper conversion course on the Mosquito, and when he went on his last mission, his navigator had not flown a Mosquito before, and one of the navigator's tasks was to change the fuel tank over." An RAF spokesman said, "A long time has elapsed since Wing Commander Guy Gibson and his navigator went down. We simply don't have the facts available to corroborate this idea, and it is therefore one of a number of theories about why the aircraft crashed."
Thanks very much, Clive.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
The Eiffel Tower and its early radio. This is an extract from an article submitted to OTN magazine by Lloyd Butler, VK5BR, RAOTC member number 1495. Think of Paris and you think of the Eiffel Tower. The Eiffel Tower of Paris was named after its designer, engineer Gustave Eiffel. The structure was built between 1887 and 1889 as an entrance arch for the Exposition Universelle at 1889 World's Fair, marking the centennial celebration of the French Revolution. It was opened on the 6th of May, 1889. The tower initially stood 300 metres tall. Built of pig iron, a very pure form of structural iron, the entire tower weighed approximately 10,000 tons. Up until 1930, it was the tallest structure in the world. In 1957, a steel mast was added at the top for radio use, such as FM and television, which increased the height to 324 metres. Lloyd's initial interest was the impressive long-wave aerial system, which, until around 1950, hung from the top of the tower, and the low-frequency radio transmission equipment which operated into it. Lloyd's first visit to Paris and the Eiffel Tower was in 1977, but by that time the long-wave aerial had long been taken down. In fact, he only learned about the aerial when he first did some research in the 1980s. It's interesting to note that the Eiffel Tower was initially given an approval for its erection to last just 20 years. At the end of the 20 years, in 1909, the city of Paris had planned to tear it down. But it was ultimately saved because of its antenna use for military and other communications applications. It's also interesting that during World War II in 1944, Hitler gave orders to his general in occupied Paris to destroy the Eiffel Tower. Fortunately, the general never carried out those orders. Like the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the tower has to be regularly painted to prevent rust. This is done every 7 years, and it takes 50 to 60 tons of paint. In the early 1900s, a set of aerial wires ran from the top of the Eiffel Tower to anchors on the Avenue de Saffron and the Champ de Mars. The aerial wires were connected to long-wave transmitters in small bunkers. However, in 1909, a permanent underground radio centre was built near the south pillar of the tower, and the radio centre is still there today. The aerial wires remained until the 1950s. The specific date of removal has been given as 1957, but one writer claimed the long-wave antenna cables were removed as early as 1946. The individual antenna wires were fed via taps partway up the aerial wire. It is estimated that those wires were around 500 metres long, but were still short compared to the long wavelength used for their early spark transmitter. Connected in at the end, radiation resistance would have been very low. Very large insulators were used to isolate the tower from the very high voltages of the antenna wires. These high voltages would have developed because of the electrically shortened loaded antenna and the high power used. Early radio communication made use of long waves and needed large aerial system. By the time the 1950s had arrived, radio communication and other services such as broadcasting and television had gradually moved on to shorter waves and different types of antenna systems. Gustav Eiffel was also active in developing radio communications. On the 5th of November 1898, he and another experimenter set up a transmitter on the third platform of the Eiffel Tower and succeeded in making the first radio contact from the tower to Pantheon, 4 kilometres away. It would have been long waves or low frequency, and one wonders what aerial he would have used. Lloyd thinks he would have just dropped a long wire straight down from the platform and operated against the iron structure of the tower. Lee DeForest is recorded in history as the inventor of the three-element vacuum tube, or Audion. He travelled to Paris in 1908 and was given permission to conduct experimental radio transmissions from the top of the Eiffel Tower. These were heard as far as Marseille, 805 kilometres away. In 1910, radio from the tower became part of the International Time Service. From May 1910, the first regular time signal could be heard from a distance of 5,200 kilometres. In 1913, the Paris Observatory, using the Eiffel Tower as an antenna, exchanged wireless signals with the United States Naval Observatory in Arlington, Virginia, to carry out a scientific experiment. The objective was to measure the difference in longitude between Washington and Paris. In 1914, during World War I, the tower aerial was used for reception as well as transmission and played a big part in intercepting the enemy's messages. They called it the Big Ear. French radio made use of the tower from 1918 and for television from 1957. The first broadcast from the tower was made by French radio in November 1921. The first television tests were made from the tower in 1925, and the first 60-line television program was broadcast in 1935. A little about the early transmitters was contained in one of the issues of the New Harmsworth Self-Educator, written by W.W. Whiffen. Photographs included were specially obtained for the encyclopedia by arrangement with the French government. Unfortunately, the printed quality of those photographs is not very good. The Harmsworth publication was not dated, but considering that the main transmitter was a high-powered spark unit and there were several early types of valve transmitter, Lloyd figured that the era concerned was the early 1920s. The spark transmitter operated on a wavelength of 2,600 metres, or 115 kHz. The spark transmissions were sent out mainly for the issue of time signals and meteorological observations. The time signals were sent out every morning at 10:30 a.m. GMT. The transmitter power was not given, but the aerial current was quoted as around 80 amps, delivering sufficient power to be received in England on a crystal set receiver. The article discussed a little about the power sources which they had available. The spark transmitter was fed with 1,000 Hz AC. To understand this, spark transmitters don't use continuous waves. They send out wave trains of damped oscillations initiated by the spark. The spark initiates the charge of energy into the tuned circuit, set at the frequency of transmission, and the waveform decays due to the natural oscillation and energy loss in the tuned circuit. The tuning inductance consisted of 40 turns of brass pipe at a 90 centimetre diameter. The tuning capacitors, mounted in oil-filled tanks, consisted of flat aluminium plates with glass dielectrics and had a total capacity of 0.55 microfarads. Another Eiffel Tower transmitter described in the Harmsworth Educator article was a pulse and arc unit, which operated from 1,000 volts DC and delivered a power of 60 kilowatts. Not a lot of detail was given, except that this transmitter was used during World War I for a military purpose. As distinct from the spark transmitters, which generated damp waves, the arc transmitter, introduced by Valdemar Poulsen, was one of the first inventions to send continuous waves. However, the characteristic of the arc was such that frequencies above 250 kHz were difficult to produce. Two other valve transmitters were briefly mentioned as part of the radio installation of that time. The first was a 1 kilowatt transmitter using 6 valves apparently fed from a high-frequency alternator, which was used for radio telegraphy. And the second was a 5 kilowatt valve AM transmitter used for broadcasting. Built as a feature for a World Expo in 1889 and a monument to the French Revolution, it was anticipated that the Eiffel Tower would be dismantled after 20 years. But after more than 120 years, it is still there today. Once the tallest structure in the world, it is visited daily by thousands of tourists who queue up for their turn in the lifts to ascend the tower. One might say that it has survived beyond the initial 20 years because it is a national monument and a great tourist attraction. However, it has also survived because of its value as a tall structure to support vital radio aerials. The long wave aerial array is long gone, but the mast at the top still supports numerous aerials for FM broadcasting and television on both VHF and UHF. Thanks to Lloyd Butler, VK5BR, for that interesting historical item.
You're listening to VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia. Perth Luncheons. The popular and well-attended monthly luncheons for ROTC members and friends in and around the Perth area are held on the second Tuesday of each month. The VK6 ROTC group have a new venue, the Woodbridge Hotel, east of Guildford. Reports indicate the hospitality to be excellent. The Perth group meet at 11:30 a.m. for lunch at 12 midday. This is not a buffet meal, but excellent food in both pensioner and standard portions are available. We would like to place orders at 12 midday, so please don't be late. This information is courtesy of Phil, VK6ZKO, whose contact details can be found on the club's website.
In keeping with tradition, we conclude this broadcast with a short story. A little girl was talking to her teacher about whales. The teacher said it was physically impossible for a whale to swallow a human, because even though it was a very large mammal, its throat was very small. The little girl stated that Jonah was swallowed by a whale. Irritated, the teacher reiterated that a whale could not swallow a human. It was physically impossible. The little girl said, "When I get to heaven, I will ask Jonah." The teacher asked, "What if Jonah went to hell?" The little girl replied, "Then you ask him." And that humorous story was supplied by Ron, VK3AFW.
That's all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. The next ROTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. If you have missed all part of this broadcast, or you just want to listen to it again, it is available for download from the ROTC website. Simply go to www.rotc.org.au. Again, the website URL is www.rotc.org.au. On the right-hand side is the main menu. Click on VK3OTN Broadcasts and will be able to see the various times and frequencies of the VK3OTN. transmissions by all of our volunteers, provided of course a volunteer is available. Down towards the bottom of the page is the current and previous 5 broadcasts for you to listen to. Sometimes the relay station is an automated broadcast, for example, a repeater, when no operator is available to take callbacks. Other times the volunteer operator suffers from very heavy local queue iron and callbacks are not always possible. Many operators need a small amount of time to switch from playing a recorded file to using a microphone. Please be mindful of this. This is VK3OTN signing clear from today's news and information session. 73 from the IOTC broadcast team.